Should a church and state? Should Christians be voting biblical principles? Does it really matter who you vote for? Join Pastor Jerry Cook as he endeavors to answer these and many other questions over the next hour on Politics in the Pulpit. And now, Pastor Jerry Cook.
Ah, the inevitable voice of Joe Messina. Always good to hear those introductory, lustry voices. Good to have you here today. KHTS AM 1220 and 98.1 FM. This is your hometown station. This is Politics in the Pulpit with Pastor Jerry Cook. Thank you very much. This is our third show, and I trust that today will be extremely important as well as stimulating for many of you out there. We're going to talk about a topic today that has been on the minds of a whole bunch of people, whether you like it or not, specifically with the churches here across the United States of America and, of course, globally. COVID-19 obviously was a big deal starting in March of 2020, shutting down churches, 2 weeks to stop the spread, all of that wonderful stuff. And here we are going into year number three. And, well, it seems like it hasn't really stopped. And, of course, one of the big things to come out of the COVID-19 hysteria has been to vaccinate or not to vaccinate. And so that has been a big debate within churches, big debate amongst Christians in general, and, of course, among the heathen themselves. Of course, they've been debating that subject as well. With me today, I am pleased to have with me, from the Unity Project, Laura Sextro, who is very instrumental in this area of vaccination and the horrible bills that are coming across the desks of some of our representatives here in the state of California. And Laura, tell us a little bit about yourself, about the Unity Project, and what people can do to become more involved.
Yeah, thank you so much for having me, Pastor. So Unity Project was started about 8 months ago. We are an organization that's tying together grassroots groups throughout the state of California, the country, and we even have strategic partners globally that are fighting vaccine mandates, and in particular with an emphasis on parental rights and medical freedom. And we started with about 120. Now we're up to over 200 strategic partners, and it continues to grow. And I think that's a representation of the fact that there are many, many people across this state that are concerned about what's happening with as it relates to, in particular, the vaccine mandates. But really, it's grown now to medical freedom, as I think is evidenced in some of these bills that we'll talk about here in a little bit. We have, I think, an amazing team. We've got Dr. Aaron Cariotti, who I know we'll be speaking with shortly. He is our chief of medical ethics. He's got a phenomenal background, and I think is really a pillar in this fight to educate and to have people understand in society the dangers of these vaccines and the necessity for medical freedom. We also have Dr. Robert Malone as our chief medical officer, and Dr. Paul Alexander is our chief scientific officer, and we have several others on our strategic advisory board. And again, the goal is really to offer a platform for these grassroots organizations to speak in a unified voice and in a collaborative manner, because what you find oftentimes when you have these concerns that are facing society, you oftentimes will have grassroots organizations that are popping up, but they're not speaking in a unified voice. They're operating in a very disparate manner, which is not always the most effective. And so, again, the Unity Project is hoping to tie all of them together so that we can be much more effective in this fight.
Laura, tell me a little bit about the position of the Unity Project in terms of the vaccination, in the sense of, are you guys saying vaccinations no for nobody, or people have the freedom to make that choice? Give me a little example of that.
Yeah, so we are a big advocate for medical freedom. So whatever you believe is the right choice for you, and in particular for your children. Mm-hmm. Although that being said, we know that the pediatric population, so defined by anyone under the age of 18, we know that they're at zero risk unless they have an extreme comorbidity. There's never been a child under the age of 18 that has passed away of COVID unless they had, again, multiple comorbidities. So we also know that children are not vectors of transmission. But then conversely, we know that as it relates to these vaccines, in particular in the pediatric population, there's a tremendous amount of risk. So if you look at the risk-benefit analysis, the risk far outweighs the benefit as it relates to these vaccines. And the other thing that I would say is, you know, people oftentimes I hear people saying informed medical decisions. I want to be very clear, and I'm sure that when we talk to Dr. Aaron Cariotti, he'll touch on this as well. We are not, as a society, operating under informed consent. Mm-hmm. To this day, we do not have a full understanding of what is contained in these vaccines. And I find that to be astonishing. I can't go to the store and buy shampoo or a box of cereal without knowing what the ingredients are. Yet, we are mass vaccinating into a population that is a developing population, meaning the pediatrics. And again, they're at zero risk, and we have no idea what's in these vaccines. So I would say, I would encourage people to think long and hard before they rush out and get their children vaccinated. That's our position.
Again, you're listening to Politics in the Pulpit here with Pastor Jerry Cook and Laura Sextrow with the Unity Project. I want to bring in, as Laura had mentioned, Dr. Aaron Cariotti. And let me just tell you a little bit about him. He graduated from Notre Dame. He earned his MD from Georgetown University, has authored several books for all kinds of various institutions. And Dr. Aaron Cariotti can speak to, I think, at least to this SB 866 lowers age of consent to 12 without parental consent or knowledge, some of these other bills that are coming out. So Dr. Aaron is also part of the Strategic Advisory Council for the Unity Project. So, Dr. Aaron, are you on?
I'm here, Pastor. Thanks. It's great to be with you.
And, Dr. Aaron, can you speak a little bit to the SB 866, how it lowers the age of consent to 12 without parental consent? And tell me a little bit about your ire and angst against that particular bill.
Yeah. So, ordinarily in medicine, children cannot consent for medical procedures, whether it is a prescription medication or an intervention like a surgery. Until they are 18, they have not reached the age at which they can give consent. Now, when they're teenagers, we do involve them in the process of medical decision making, but ultimately still their parents are responsible for saying, yes, you can take my child into surgery to take out, you know, her gallbladder, or you can give my child this antidepressant medication, whatever the case may be. This bill would create a special carve-out just for vaccines, specifically for COVID vaccines. And as Laura already pointed out, adults right now are hamstrung, are impaired in terms of their ability to give informed consent, not because they necessarily have something wrong with them cognitively or intellectually, but because they're not necessarily given accurate information about the real risks and benefits, first of all, of COVID. People grossly overestimate their risks of dying or having a bad outcome from COVID. And we know that if you're under the age of 50, particularly, you have an extremely low risk of mortality from COVID, lower probably than your risk of mortality from influenza. Most people are not aware of that. Most people are not aware of the fact that Laura mentioned earlier that healthy children are at zero risk from dying from COVID. So without a good understanding of our risks with COVID, we can't give informed consent. But also without a good understanding of the actual risks and benefits of the vaccines, we can't give adequate informed consent. So we're proposing in this current climate of kind of inaccurate information on both of these things, minimizing the risks of the vaccine, which are very real, overestimating the risks of COVID. We're proposing introducing a situation in which children can supposedly give informed consent. So you take a child at school who's induced and incentivized and maybe even pressured socially to be part of the in-group that has, you know, gotten their sticker for getting vaccinated, gotten their good citizen, you know, good behavior report for getting vaccinated. That child is not going to be in a position to withstand pressures either from peers or from teachers or from the school nurse or what have you to accept or decline an intervention like this. So it's really an attempt to do an end run around, first of all, parental rights to, you know, control healthcare decisions for their own children. And to do an end run around that specifically to serve the interests of the pharmaceutical companies that are making a lot of money off vaccines when they're given to new populations, right? So if we say this is a population under the age of 18 that doesn't really need the COVID vaccine, it's not really going to benefit from them. It's going to put them at unnecessary risk. that's going to cut into the profits of lots of folks that are making money on these vaccines. So, I think it's important to understand the economic climate, the social climate of the current situation in order to see whose interests a bill like this is actually serving.
Sure.
And, the folks that have introduced this and the other bill that we may be talking about today, it's clearly have financial conflicts of interest in terms of their strong ties to the pharmaceutical industry.
Sure. I have a question for both you and Laura. This term vaccination, of course, we're all familiar with being vaccinated, and we've heard the term vaccination for years and years and years and years. The word defined is treatment with a vaccine to produce immunity against a disease or inoculation. Of course, COVID-19 vaccines, according to the CDC.gov, vaccines are effective at protecting people from getting seriously ill, being hospitalized, and even dying, especially people who are boosted. But really, is it silly to call this a vaccine when in reality it's not producing the immunity that a vaccination is supposed to do, for instance, like polio or measles or what have you? But I'll go ahead and ask you, Doctor, first, if you would, and then Laura, if you would, jump in.
Yeah, so I think you're exactly right. These cannot really be meaningfully called vaccines. The definition, the CDC's own definition of vaccine was changed after the introduction of the COVID vaccines to try to include them. But of course, the traditional vaccine definition is something that's given that produces immunity from infection, which these vaccines clearly do not do. Shortly after these vaccines are given, it looks like they may diminish the risk of severe symptoms, but only for a very limited period of time. Once you get to month 4, 5, 6, that's diminishing very significantly, hence the need for boosters. And there's now actually evidence from highly vaccinated and highly boosted regions that the vaccines have what we call negative efficacy, meaning not only do they not work, but they work in the opposite direction. In other words, if you've been vaccinated and boosted, once you get through that initial month or two of protection, then your risk of infection actually increases compared to unvaccinated individuals. You can mask that a little bit by giving an additional booster, but the efficacy window for the boosters is even shorter. So with each subsequent shot, you get less protection and you get a shortened period of time that it works. And then after that period of time, again, it seems not just to take you back to zero or to the baseline that you were at before vaccination. It actually looks like you're at an enhanced risk of infection. And this idea that it protects you from severe illness and death starts to look very questionable at that point as well. So I think these are novel, or I would say even experimental genetic therapies that were utilized on a wide scale. And the experiment didn't pan out very well. These things turned out not to work in the ways that we wanted, hence why we're still dealing with the coronavirus pandemic, even after the mass vaccination campaign.
And here we are as the guinea pigs. So, Laura, would it be ludicrous to call the COVID vaccine a vaccine?
I think it's absolutely ludicrous. There is no, as Dr. Aaron Curiati just said, you can still acquire and transmit the virus even after having received the quote-unquote vaccine. And one of the things it's interesting to me, I'm reading this book, Neither Safe Nor Effective, by Dr. Colleen Huber. I hope I'm saying her name right. She references in this book that there was not a single trial animal study done on these COVID vaccines that was successful. 100% of the animal studies failed. And so one would have to even question, how did it get to a point where we went on to have human trials? And Dr. Curiati, you could probably speak to this better than I could. As I understand it, there's a very specific process and chronology of clinical trials. And if you're failing 100% of your animal trials, you don't go on to conducting human trials.
Dr. Curiati, can you speak to that?
Yeah, that's correct. You have to show proof of safety and at least some evidence of efficacy in animal models, or in giving medicine or vaccine to animals, before you before you trial the vaccine in humans. And the next phase is you give it to a large number of healthy humans to see if it's safe, see what kind of side effects you get. And then after that, you do the phase three of the FDA trial, which is a randomized controlled trial where you have a placebo arm, an arm where people get, you know, a sugar pill or a fake, you know, saltwater injection in the case of a vaccine, and you compare the outcomes. What happened with these vaccines, because they were rolled out under this state of emergency, this kind of legal framework that governed basically everything that happened during the COVID response, that the trial period was shortened. We had a very rapid push to get to the human clinical trials before adequate animal studies were done. So this technology was kind of rushed to market. Defenders of the mRNA vaccines will say, well, this technology has been around for a decade or more, and we've been testing it for a decade or more. But what they don't tell you is that most of those tests have failed, actually. The reason that it hasn't yet been rolled out in human clinical trials or human populations until COVID is that the outcomes from the early studies didn't look very good. And yet it was chosen during COVID for a number of reasons, some of which didn't make a lot of biological sense. But, I mean, one of the reasons was that this mRNA platform would allow it to be mass-produced very quickly, much more quickly than a traditional vaccine. Mm-hmm. So I think there were a number of factors at work, but this idea that we're under this state of emergency, we have to do something very quickly, people use that with good intentions and sometimes with not so good intentions, sure, to set aside the ordinary sort of safety protocols and the ordinary checks and balances that should operate on the system. And we sort of tossed the rule book overboard, not only with this intervention, but with many other things. You mentioned lockdowns earlier. Lockdowns were never a part of traditional public health measures until COVID. They had never actually been tested on human populations before.
Dr. Aaron, before we get to the break here, could you speak very briefly to this notion of, or whether it might be more philosophical here, but do you think there's something insidious behind the vaccination push and why there's such a flurry and frenzy to make sure that everyone gets the vaccination, gets boosted, all this? Do you think there's something insidious behind this?
So the short answer to that is yes. I don't think you need to aver to really complex, theories or conspiracies to explain that. I mean, the simple place to start is just by following the money.
Sure.
The COVID vaccines were $100 billion industry in their first year. That's a lot of money at stake. And you can explain a lot of what's going on just by the power and influence that, you know, that kind of money can purchase for you. I think the vaccine mandates were also closely connected to the infrastructure of vaccine passports. And so it was an opportunity to roll out a mechanism of digital surveillance and control over populations that a lot of economic and political interests are heavily invested in. So this idea that I have to show a QR code demonstrating that I've done what I've been told to do in order to engage in ordinary human activities like traveling or going to a restaurant or going to a public event, this would have been rejected outright prior to the COVID pandemic. But after a year of lockdowns, people were willing to accept infringements on civil liberties that in ordinary times they never would have accepted just to try to get back to some semblance of normal life. And so we embrace this concept of the vaccine passport, and that infrastructure is still in place, even if it's not being utilized in a lot of jurisdictions right now. And there will be another public health crisis coming down the pike, and there will be various social issues redefined as a public health crisis, like climate change, for example. People have proposed rolling lockdowns to deal with climate change. People have proposed using the digital infrastructure to monitor, you know, people's movements and their gasoline consumption and their carbon footprint in order to deal with lockdowns. So that's, you know, this is a system that gives technocrats massive amounts of power and control and the ability to surveil people using these technologies. And I think that whole project was very, very rapidly accelerated during the pandemic in a kind of opportunistic way. And vaccines were a good way to advance that agenda.
Yeah. Well, thank you, Doctor. What do you think, Aaron? Laura, do you think that there's something insidious here? Do you think that the United States government needs to be completely and fully trusted without any kind of any kind of research behind that? What do you think?
Absolutely not. I don't trust the government to, and I certainly don't trust the government to be in a position of engaging in my healthcare. That's, you know, and unfortunately, bills like 2098 here in the state of California are going to, in my opinion, are somewhat designed to completely dismantle and destroy the medical system. And you know, so for those of you who don't know 2098, this is a bill that essentially states that doctors must go in complete compliance with the COVID guidelines that are set forth by the CDPH and the CDC and the NIH and any other acronym for the state and federal government. And should they choose to practice medicine in accordance with their Hippocratic Oath and their ethical, you know, values, that and potentially recommends another course of treatment for a patient, and unfortunately, their licenses will be put up for review, and that essentially means that their licenses will be revoked. And as Dr. Cariotti has said in the past, that's akin to a lawyer being disbarred. So, and the minute that you do that, that really opens the door for the total destruction, because then it's, you know, anyone who's involved in integrative medicine or anyone that's a chiropractor or alternative medication, any type of environment that would lend itself to critical thinking and treating the patients in the best individual care that they can receive, that would then be shut down. And I'm deeply concerned because, you know, I believe that, yes, I'm concerned that the government has its hand in a lot of this, as well as the pharmaceutical companies. And I'm sure there's a lot, if you start to peel back the layers, there's probably a tremendous amount of correlation between those two.
Sure.
And, you know, Dr. Cariotti and I have had many, many conversations. I know he's got a new book coming out that addresses a lot of this. And it's unfortunate because this is becoming, you know, that term, the new normal. This is becoming the new normal. And unfortunately for us, here in the state of California, should 2098 pass, as we, you know, healthcare as we know it will become obsolete. And it won't be obsolete in a good way. And I'm sure that, and I would actually love for Dr. Cariotti to weigh in on this, because he obviously has a background in, not only as a doctor, but in medical ethics.
So what do you think about that, Doctor, this AB 2098?
So I think Laura's absolutely right. The title of my book is actually The New Abnormal. trying to push back against what's being proposed here. But 2098 is, in my judgment, the most dangerous of the really bad new bills that has been introduced in California. And the reason is it doesn't just compromise medical care in relation to one illness, COVID or COVID vaccination, or taking away parental rights in relation to one type of medical decision, which is bad enough. But it basically will give the state total control over every aspect of medicine by giving the state the ability to, you know, unjustly discipline and punish physicians who challenge any of the state bureaucracy's public health recommendations. And so that's the reason why I think Laura's warning that this will change medicine as we know it is not an exaggeration. That is, in fact, what will happen if this bill passes. Nobody wants to go to a physician who is muzzled by the state, right? If you ask your physician a question, you want the physician to be able to give you the answer that they actually believe.
Yeah.
Now, you may take or leave their recommendation. You may disagree with them. You may listen to them and then decide, oh, I want to go get a second opinion.
But how can you possibly trust your physician if you don't believe they're telling you what they actually think, right? And 2098 will take away the physician's ability to do that, or will be only very few physicians who still say what they think, and then they will be they'll be quickly silenced by the state. So this is a real problem.
Well, you, Dr. Aaron, are definitely not somebody who is muzzled, and we thank you very much for joining us today on Politics in the Pulpit. And your voice is going to be probably one of the most important voices going forward when it comes to this whole conversation. And I pray and hope that this bill dies the death of many cuts, hopefully. But we're going to go to a break here in just a second. We're going to come back with Politics in the Pulpit, talking with Laura Sextrow with the Unity Project. Again, thank you, Dr. Aaron Cariotti, for all that you do, and looking forward to that new book. We'll see you in a little bit. To Politics and the Pulpit here on KHTS, your hometown station, 98.1 FM and AM 1220. Well, we are here with Laura Sextrow with the Unity Project. We just had the privilege of talking to Dr. Aaron Cariotti. We're talking about COVID-19. We're talking about the vaccine mandates. We're talking about several Senate bills and Assembly bills that are coming through the pike here in California. And I want to deal with a couple of them real quick before we're going to be privileged to have Dr. Paul
Alexander
yes. calling in. And he'll be calling in here in a few minutes, and so excited to talk to him briefly. But let's talk a little bit about SB 871, adding COVID-19 to a list of immunizations for private and public school, regardless of FDA approval.
That's correct.
What say you, Laura?
Oh my goodness, I have a lot to say about this. So, as we were discussing before, one has to question what is the motive of mass vaccinating, excuse me.
Oh, your tongue was in the way of your lip.
I know, yeah. Yes. Well, and I've got mask, right? We were talking about masks and vaccines. So one has to question what is the motive behind this, considering that we know children are not vectors of transmission. We know that they're at zero risk. And we also know that there are tremendous risks for the pediatric population with these vaccines. And so, again, I personally have to question what is the motive behind this. I know it's been this bill has been tabled, but I personally believe that they will probably resurrect this. It feels particularly concerning. And then if you couple that with SB 866, which we just talked about with Dr. Cariotti, I have visions of these, well, let me back up and say, in the state of California, we know that they have about $1 billion that they're dedicating in the budget to the vaccine programs. And part of that is we know that school districts individually also get funding. Mm-hmm. And we've seen in this past year that there were vaccine vans that were showing up at schools in LA Unified School District.
I bet that was fun.
Right. Can you imagine? Here comes the white van that pulls up in front of the school.
Here comes the ouch van.
Right. Instead of giving kids candy, it's giving them vaccines. And so if you couple 871 with 866, which is the bill that will lower age of consent to 12, now you have a situation where the school has absolutely zero obligation to inform parents that they're going to have a vaccine van show up. And then the kids, you drop your kids off at school and they get lined up with the rest of the kids because they're not going to break free and say, oh, no, I'm not going to get vaccinated. They're going to do what the rest of their classmates are doing, and they're going to get vaccinated and boosted. And you as a parent will have no right to know or give your consent.
Laura, speak to this, if you would. Just in the last year and a half or so, we have seen parents showing up to school boards. Mm-hmm. We have seen parents being very vocal about the sex education, mm-hmm. The blatant sex education that is being forced down the proverbial throat of our kids. Mm-hmm. We had, of course, the Virginia elections. We have all these things happening. Parents are getting more and more engaged. And I am amazed at how many parents, even within the Christian community, seem to be very satisfied and relatively compliant with a lot of these strange mandates that are coming down through the pike. In particular, let's talk a little bit about this AB 1993.
Yes.
This is the strangest thing in the world. I don't know why it's called 1993. I don't know if that was a great year for some of the Democrats that are sitting in the assembly right now, but it requires vaccination, COVID-19 vaccination for all employees and independent contractors to even work in the state of California?
That's right, yeah. So we know that the Supreme Court shot down Biden's federal mandate for employees of 100, employers of 100 plus, right? So now this is the state level's version, but it takes it one step further. This bill, should it be resurrected, and I again, I believe that these bills absolutely will be resurrected, states that if you plan on engaging in any form of commerce in the state of California, that you have to prove your vaccine status, and that includes independent contractors. And you know, I've spoken to people that say, "Oh, I'm a business owner, so that doesn't apply to me." Well, if you're a business owner, you're an employee of your business, right? So therefore, you will have to prove your vaccine status. And absolutely, the government will have a force that goes out and inspects and makes sure, and then you will be slapped with heavy, heavy fines to the extent that it will probably make it impossible for you to even operate in the state of California. So what it's going to do is it's going to create either a black market or primarily, you know, black market or people doing stuff, you know, behind closed doors where the government isn't involved. And it's shocking to me. Again, you just heard the conversation with Aaron Cariotti. And that we discuss, these vaccines are not truly vaccines. They're not stopping the spread of the infection or acquisition of the virus, right?
Yep.
But yet we have the state of California saying that if you want to engage in any form of commerce, that you must prove your vaccine status. And at the Unity Project, we always say, look, if you want to live, work, or learn in the state of California, then you need to get involved. You need to understand what's happening with these bills, and you need to make your voice heard and have your elected officials understand that they can no longer hide behind kind of this veil of anonymity as it relates to authorship of these bills and their voting records for these bills.
Well, I say a huge amen to that, Laura. On our line today, we have Dr. Paul Alexander, the Chief Scientific Officer for the Unity Project. Welcome, Dr. Paul, to Politics and the Pulpit. This is Pastor Jerry Cook speaking with Laura Sextra with the Unity Project. Say hello.
Hey, how are you? Dr. Alexander here. Can you hear me?
I can hear you, sir. How are you?
Not bad. Thank you very much. And once again, speaking with Laura and anything connected to Unity is always an honor and a privilege. They're doing tremendous work, particularly in the area of helping educate the public on the dangers and the challenges with the vaccines in children. And I think, just to echo what Laura was saying, I think the ridiculousness of this is really seen in the governor, Governor Newsom, because here he was two weeks ago, coming out saying that he had two boosters, so he had four shots in all. Yet he tested positive and came out to say that he thanked the vaccine for protecting him. So that was ridiculous at that point because the vaccine, as Aaron has said, has failed. It completely fails on the Omicron variant. The vaccine does not sterilize the virus. So it does not prevent infection, does not prevent transmission. And more importantly, we know now that what is happening, though, at a molecular level, at a cellular level, is that the vaccine, the antibodies, the vaccinal antibodies are actually binding to the virus's spike. So in this case, the Omicron spike, but it's binding but not neutralizing the virus. So it's actually enhancing and facilitating infection, causing infection in the vaccinated. And Newsom actually turned around and said, he has symptoms and he's taking Paxlovid. Paxlovid, I believe, is the Pfizer antiviral. Well, we know also that the Pfizer antiviral has is creating a problem for Pfizer and the users in that it's causing rebound COVID symptoms. But this just goes to show you that if Newsom was confident in the vaccine's capacity, he would not be taking an antiviral. Because his doctor would put him on antiviral, it means that they're not confident in the vaccine's ability to reduce symptoms. And the vaccine only reduces mild symptoms, to be frank. So if it works at all, which I argue it has never. So here you have the governor of California and these people mandating these vaccines, when the governor of California has taken four shots, it has failed, he's gotten COVID infected again, he has symptoms, and he's even digging into the war chest and using an antiviral because he does not trust the fourth shot even to give him any kind of protection against even mild symptoms. Mm-hmm. So it is all ludicrous to somebody like me at this point.
Well, you know, it's funny, Dr. Paul, is just before we went on the air a little over an hour ago, I was on my way to the studio, and I heard on the radio that Dr. Fauci has got COVID today, and so does Maxine Waters. And if I'm not mistaken, the administration's HH secretary has gotten it in the last couple weeks as well. And these are guys that are, you know, double boosted, vaccinated. I mean, you know, everything that they throw down the pike, they do it. And here they are getting sick. And we were just talking with Dr. Aaron Cariotti as well as Laura Sextra in the earlier segment. We were talking about how the word vaccination should not even be applied to this COVID-19 vaccine because obviously it's not actually producing immunity against the COVID-19. If it's not producing immunity, Dr. Paul, what is it producing?
Well, you're bang on. And Laura and Aaron were correct. The problem is that we knew this very early on, maybe 1 year ago, soon after the vaccine. Well, these are really, from my point of view, injections, inoculations. They don't function classically as vaccines. But the truth of the matter is this. We found out that after the Barnstable outbreak in Massachusetts in 2021, Dr. Rochelle Walensky, the CDC director, rushed out to the podium to tell the vaccinated, double vaccinated at that point, people in America that you needed to be, to put on the mask because they realized that the vaccine had failed. And at that point, we were still dealing with Delta. Mm-hmm. And yeah, the Omicron is much more infectious, much milder, but much more infectious. It means that the issue here is this. If you bring a vaccine that does not sterilize the virus, that means it does not provide protection. What you are doing is it doesn't neutralize. The antibodies are not neutralizing anymore. What you're doing, though, is you are putting the virus, the infectiousness of the virus, the spike, you're putting it under what we call selection pressure. By putting the spike under pressure via Darwinian natural selection, and they knew this, the CDC, the NIH, the FDA, Bula from Pfizer, Bansal from Moderna, they knew that natural selection will cause selection of the more fittest variants that could overcome that suboptimal immune pressure on the spike, and that those variants would be selected.
Did we lose
And
you
they
there?
Will become enriched in the environment,
yeah,
and they will become the new dominant variant. So to speak, if you want this pandemic to continue for 100 more years, if you want infectious variant to emerge after infectious variant approximately every 2 months, then you continue using these very same vaccines because they have all failed. And everyone involved, Fauci, Walensky, Bula, Bansal, Francis Collins, they all know that the vaccine is based on the initial legacy Wuhan strain. For over 1 year now, it cannot and it could never hit the present Omicron BA4, BA5 subvariant. Right. The vaccine has failed. They need to stop this. And under no condition, under absolutely no condition, must an American parent follow the FDA and allow these vaccines in their children. These vaccines have not been properly tested. I am telling parents in America, based on the data today, based on all we know now after over 1 year of this vaccine rollout, that you could potentially harm your child and they are going to be American children who will die. I am not saying may die. They are American children, like adults, who will die from these vaccines. You cannot allow these vaccines.
Fauci, Walensky, Francis Collins. No one, not one public health official, no one in the Trump administration and no one in the Biden administration has ever prosecuted a case or the case as to why your child should be vaccinated under no condition. This is a hill that parents in America, mothers in America, must be willing to defend and even put your life on the line. You must protect your children. These vaccines will harm your child.
Well, Dr. Paul, I can hear the passion in your voice and the drive. And just on a side note here, Laura and I were talking during the break about an event that would spark just equal passion in your voice. Laura, why don't you remind him of that?
Well, we were talking, and before I bring that up, I just want to say, for those of you who don't know Dr. Paul Alexander, he is it's an honor to work with him. He's an incredible warrior in this, and he was a senior advisor to the World Health Organization. He also worked under the Trump administration and had direct dealings with Dr. Fauci. And I know, Paul, you've had some negative consequences as a result of speaking truth. And and he also, you know, Dr. Paul Alexander is an evidence-based, Oxford-trained medical expert. So maybe if you are interested in sharing with everyone the unfortunate circumstances by you speaking the truth with regard to this pandemic and with Dr. Fauci.
Well, I'll give you an example. My role was a senior pandemic advisor in the Trump administration under President Trump, which I actually did want to work in that capacity, and I was happy I did. I supported him, to be quite blunt and open to you. Now, what happened was, in my capacity, there was a period where the pandemic task force, those people like Fauci, Burks, etc., Redfield, when they had to go into the public and go on the mainstream media and discuss whatever they wanted to discuss on the pandemic, they would inform different offices in the government, particularly the offices that I was connected to. And long story short, one communication from the NIH was informing everyone that Dr. Fauci was going on talk shows the coming weekend, and he was going to discuss issues around school closures and masking for children. And when the communication came, I looked at the communication and informed Dr. Fauci, the NIH, CDC, everyone involved. I responded and I said, because I was emailed myself, and I said, look, Dr. Fauci is clearly wrong and is not on top of the science. NIH is wrong. The science shows us that school closures are devastating on children and harming our children. We were getting reports of children committing suicide. And I also explained that the mask mandates were highly ineffective and the masks were actually toxic. So I attached a bunch of studies in response. And I said, this is the science that informs me to show you that the lockdowns are ineffective and wrong and the mask mandates are wrong. Needless to say, I was informed that that was a no-no. That I was told personally that you don't school Dr. Fauci or the NIH, and that the bureaucracy at the CDC, the NIH, etc., are going to move to get you terminated and ensure that you never work in Washington, etc., or your career is done because you did that. And I was kind of concerned because I was in Washington, I was with my family, well, just part of my family. But it was a very trying time. It was a very isolating time because, you know, the media were like rabid animals and they mistreated me. Well, not just me, anyone connected in the Trump administration. So the long and short of it was that they actually moved to get me terminated. And there was a lot of pressure. I resigned, but I responded this way. I made a decision that I'm a technically competent person. I work for the World Health Organization in a pandemic advising capacity. I work for the Trump administration. I work for the Infectious Disease Society of America for 3 years at headquartered in Wilson Avenue in Virginia, etc. I work for the government of Canada as an epidemiologist globally. I work for the WHO in Europe as a regional epidemiologist for Russia, Turkey, Ukraine, Poland, etc. So I'm...
Oh, have we got him?
I will punish them all. And I would use my science and my technical capacity to work with Harvey Reich, Peter McCullough, etc. on early treatment. And I will try and share with the world and the American population everything I could about COVID, everything I could about early treatment, everything I could about the vaccines, and to help them make informed, sensible decisions. And that's what I've been doing, and I've been very proud to be connected and tethered to Laura Central. They're doing tremendous work.
Thank you, Paul. If I could just add to really quickly, you know, I had one of the things that's unique about the doctors that we've spoken with today, unlike maybe some of the other doctors that are making some of these recommendations for vaccines, is that, you know, these are the folks that are actually involved in really digging down and understanding the data in a way that most of the medical communities could not do. And I'll share with you, I had a personal experience. I went to see a doctor, and just by chance, I said, listen, what's your position on the vaccine? I wanted to see what his answer was. And he immediately said, hey, I'm pro-vaccine. And I said, why? Can you tell me why? How do you, as a medical professional, understand why you want to recommend this particular vaccine? Don't you have a fiduciary duty to understand that before you recommend it to your patients?
Yeah.
And his answer was, I just really believe in the vaccine. And what he was telling me was essentially he was following whatever the guidelines of the CDC and the NIH were telling them, but there's no further research that's being done. And that's why I always say, you know, people like Dr. Paul Alexander or Dr. Pierre Corey or Peter McCullough, and the list goes on, these are the doctors that are actually in the trenches, understanding the epidemiology and the science and the medical data behind this.
Dr. Paul, thank you very much for joining us today on Politics in the Pulpit, and I thank you very much for your passion, and I pray that God will give you continued health and continue the good fight.
I appreciate that, sir. It's an honor and a privilege. Thank you very much.
Thank you, sir. And it has been our privilege today to have Laura Sextro from the Unity Project. And if you want more information about the Unity Project, I encourage you to go right over to their website and look at all the information that is available to you. And Laura, at some point, I'm going to come onto a podcast in the future. Yes. if you so still want me to do so.
Absolutely.
And it has been our pleasure to have you today on Politics in the Pulpit. And I'll go ahead and give you the last word before I end up really, really, really having the last word.
Well, thank you so much. And we absolutely want you on the podcast. I think that you have a lot to say and you're a wealth of knowledge. I would just ask everyone to go to unityproject.com. And in particular, go to the Take Action tab, look at the bills, make sure that you understand what's happening in your state.
Absolutely. Thank you very much, Laura. Again, you're listening to Politics in the Pulpit. We'll see you next week here on KHTS AM 1220, 98.1 FM, your hometown station.
You've been listening to Politics in the Pulpit with Pastor Jerry Cook.